Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, a weekly public affairs series featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute which encourages excellence in scholarship and seeks to affirm the importance of the humanities in American life.
You cannot construe language independently of some or other structure of assumptions. That what that means is that there are always constraints. It also means that the constraints are not themselves obvious and perspicuous to everyone, and in fact, the constraints are challengeable.
Literature and Society, this week on Soundings. My guest is Stanley Fish, chairman of the Department of English at Duke University. Stanley Fish's most recent book is Doing What Comes Naturally, published last year by Duke University Press. Doing What Comes Naturally includes essays on rhetoric, the practice of theory in literary and legal studies, sports in America, and the poet John Milton. Here is Stanley Fish.
Well, the questions of intention and interpretation, or intention or interpretation, these are very vexed questions. I think that to some extent, the question of intention is the more vexed one, because it had been assumed under the aegis of New Criticism that one way of interpreting poems, and indeed the most fruitful way, was to ignore the intentions of the author and simply to attend to what the words said, to what the poem in and of itself
The New Criticism, you're just looking at this thing on the page.
That's right.
You don't care about the biography. You don't care about any of these sort of external circumstances.
And therefore, recourse to intention was thought to be recourse to some interior psychological entity of which one could only have a mediated knowledge, as opposed to the knowledge one could have of the words that were palpably there on the page. But it has seemed to some of us that, in fact, the shape that the words have on the page for someone is always a function of the assumed intention, that is, the intention one assumes the producer of the words to have had. I don't mean that, as it is sometimes thought, that you first read the words and then try to figure out what the intention that produced them is. Rather, it's my assumption, and the assumption of some others, that one reads within a prior awareness or guess at intention, and it's in relation to that awareness that the words then acquire the shape and meaning that they seem to you to have.
All right. Now, how particular does that context have to be, Stanley Fish? The problem gets, I mean, if we follow this logic all the way back, words mean nothing. I mean, we always have this recourse to a, as you say, a particular set of circumstances.
Right.
And we don't, in
fact. Well, yes, we always do.
Do we?
There are two, I think, wrong directions in which to go in discussing a problem like this. One is the direction in which some so-called hardcore literalists want to go. And that is the direction of thinking that language, or at least specially and carefully crafted language, in effect directs or constrains its own interpretation. Now, I think that's incorrect, but the other alternative, which says that therefore, in the absence of such determinate verbal constraints, words can mean anything one likes, is also incorrect. Interesting fact that in the 16th and 17th centuries, especially around the issue of biblical interpretation, the questions that we now debate in literary and cultural theory were being debated, often with a subtlety and rigor that we have not yet matched.
Are you talking about what, literal readings of the Bible?
I'm talking about arguments about the Bible, about how to read it, about the ways in which it could possibly be read, and whether or not there is a, what we might now call, a strict constructionist reading of the Bible, or whether the Bible was to be read metaphorically or analogically or anagogically.
All right, now let me get you to pause on this. I don't want to spend too much time on it, Stanley Fish, but tell me about about the incident in, what is it, the divorce tract, something like that,
yeah,
where Milton is talking about Christ's words,
yes,
a man putting a woman away, divorce.
Yes, Milton is arguing for a form of no-fault divorce more liberal than any we have yet been able to institute. However, and this is an important point, in any context, arguments that you make have to be made in relation to what is considered by your audience to be the authoritative sources at the moment.
Uh-huh.
In 1642, that 43 actually, that means, of course, the Bible. Therefore, Milton knows that in order to make this argument, the arena that he has now entered is filled with people who will quote the Bible either for his position or against his position.
That's going to be the final word.
Right. And the verse that he knows his opponents are going to cite against him, that is, the verse which seems to them to absolutely forbid divorce, is a verse in the Gospel of Matthew spoken by Christ in which he says that you cannot put away a wife unless it be for one reason, the reason of adultery, in effect having caught her in the act, and that if you put your wife away for any other reason, you yourself have committed a sin. Now, so Milton takes that particular utterance.
Is he going to, what, turn it on its head?
Of Christ, and yes, what he asks a simple question. In what context, in what set of circumstances, with what particular intentions did Christ say this? It turns out that he said it to the Pharisees. And he said it to the Pharisees as they were trying, as Milton says, to tempt him to a particular lax or loose interpretation of the law.
All right, now the Pharisees, just as a footnote, Stanley Fisher, are the ones who are known for being
literal,
rigidly interpretive.
Rigidly literal in their interpretations.
All right.
Therefore, says Milton, when he gives this harsh, literal answer, he gives it to the Pharisees. That is, he answers them in their own terms because that's the only kind of answer they can understand. But he does not mean that, says Milton, for those who are not of Pharisaical temper.
So he's got, what, another audience
right,
in mind?
Right. And then, of course, the people who fill that audience are John Milton and those of his readers he's trying to persuade. Now, if this works, what has happened is that Milton has changed one sense of what we might call the intentional interpretive context in which Christ's words were produced. Once this change occurs, the words then seem to have an entirely different meaning, equally clear and literal, than the meaning they had before.
All right, well, just as a footnote to this part of our conversation, Stanley Fish, what about the fact that John Milton was accused of self-justification, that he wanted to get rid of a wife,
mm-hmm,
that this is a form of misogyny,
mm-hmm,
and that he's exercising all of this wonderful, flashy rhetoric just for self-serving ends? What about that?
Well, that is, of course, a possible way to counter Milton's reading, although one could then, if one were Milton, say in response, my particular motives may be the ones that you have specified, but that has nothing to do with the force of my argument.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he could have made that separation. He could have also said, although he probably wouldn't have said this in 1643, that everyone is always speaking out of strategical motives, and therefore to point out that he is doing so is not to point out anything that is particularly offensive on his part.
All right, let's point the conversation in yet another direction here, Stanley Fish. You're the author of Doing What Comes Naturally. The charge arises in this book that the literary academy, particularly the professors of English, are full of fear and self-loathing. They really take it on the chin. Every time we have one of these modern language association conventions, some smart aleck reporter will come in and write something that says, can you believe all these bozos and the stupid topics?
It's usually
there?
Israel Schenker.
All right. Give me some discussion on the circumstances that create this situation. How do you look at it?
Well, I think that what creates this situation is the general feeling among the public that reading literature is something that anyone can do, as opposed, let's say, to understanding nuclear physics. So that if there's a convention of nuclear physicists and the reports are not fathomable to the general public, this is precisely what they expect. And rather than being angry, they are properly respectful and in awe.
Uh-huh.
But if, in fact, there's a report of a literary conference where works that lay persons have in fact read,
yeah,
are being discussed and then discussed in terms that they find incomprehensible, they react in anger and indignation and are very, very susceptible to being told that the critical or literary academy is engaged in obfuscating activity which is designed merely to serve their own professional ends.
All right, what about the charge also that we are trivializing, that we are finding in detective fiction, women's fiction, you name it, you know, sort of gay, lesbian, Chicano poetry on the fourth block in such and such a little town in Dallas, Texas, that, come on, this isn't really the proper study of the literary enterprise,
well,
is it?
Well, now you've gone into an area that is, as you know, beset with pitfalls for everyone who enters into it. I've just written a paper, in fact, completed it yesterday, called The Common Touch or One Size Fits All. And I even have a third possible title, Just Say Yes. Which is an investigation of what has variously been called the curricular debate or the canon wars, etc.
Right.
My point in this piece is to discuss the appearance in the literature that's grown up around these questions of the word common, because that's the word that's most often invoked. We must have a common set of standards. There must be a common set of works in relation to which our education can be organized, works that transmit and support the values that we would like to inform our society. I think if you were to ask the question, how has the current debate affected actual curricula in particular universities and colleges, I would think that you would find that the effect was, at least at this point, not very great. Mm-hmm. Because as many have complained, curricula change is extremely slow. Many committee meetings, it often takes years.
But it's on the horizon.
But there's another way in which this debate has a great deal of effect, and that is, first, in the public perception of what the humanities are doing or not doing, and second, in the kinds of efforts and energies that must be expended both by faculty members and administrators in order to maintain, if they are going to maintain, public support. We, that is, those academics who are involved in various kinds of experimental programs, have been put on the defensive in the mm-hmm. last 5 or 6 years, both by the official educational establishment of people like William Bennett and Lynn Cheney, and by the enormous popularity, at least relative popularity, of books like Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind or E.D. Hirsch's Cultural Literacy.
All right, well, again, let's not spend too much time on this particular part of the conversation, Stanley Fish. What direction do you want to see undergraduate education take?
Well, as many of my readers often complain, I'm short on specific agendas. Because it seems to me that what happens in education is that something like the marketplace is always operating. That is, rather
is that a dirty word or a good word?
Not for me, it's not. Rather than it being the case that either we have this core tradition which we must maintain against all possible encroachments, or that we should throw everything away and start all over again, it seems to me to be the case that there is always a situation in which our curriculum is evolving and modifying. Things are changing, but changing in the context of certain assumptions that don't change, and that we have a slow and sometimes not so slow reconfiguring of something that is more or less continuous in history. So, in general, I don't have any large plan. In the context of the particular moment, I welcome the recent proliferation of different traditions and different kinds of texts which are now available both to students and to researchers, for a very obvious professional reason. This means that there is more interesting work to be done, both of a historical and an interpretive kind, and I cannot see how the fact of more resources for describing and understanding our various cultures could be a regrettable fact.
We're going to finally be forced, after a fashion, to take this notion of the melting pot seriously. We're going to have to take this multicultural stuff seriously
But I must disagree with you, Wayne, respectfully, of course, because melting pot is exactly, I think, the ideology that no longer has the strength that it once had.
Should we talk?
I think, I don't know how we should talk, but insofar as the melting pot ideology, which is the one in which I was educated in the late 50s and early 60s, puts a premium on assimilation. That is, you assimilate. The differences that might divide you from other Americans are bracketed, perhaps even discarded,
right.
And you begin to participate in the fashioning and sustaining of something called the American way of life. That melting pot ideology or image has been replaced now for very complicated reasons, and it is now more fashionable to embrace one's ethnic heritage, to seek out one's roots, to hold up for admiration and analyses regional, gender, racial, national, and other literatures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we now have not one literary culture,
but many.
But many.
Right.
And that's what people who, like me, remember when there was one are complaining about. When I got to the University of Pennsylvania in 1955 as a freshman, it was very comforting for me to realize that all of these people in my dormitory, whom I had never seen before, also had read Silas Marner and one of three Shakespearean tragedies and Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold,
right,
and one Scott Fitzgerald novel, et cetera, et cetera. It provided that illusory in some sense, but still real psychological sense of community that I, as a freshman, and I assume my fellow freshmen, very much needed. What we didn't realize then is that this supposed common culture was only common to people who had been fortunate enough to go to good high schools or prep schools in Great Neck, New York, or
right,
Palo Alto, California, or Grosse Pointe, or Shaker Heights in Cleveland, and a whole series of suburbs, which were the only people we ever knew.
Right.
And so it seemed to us to be an absolutely universal common set of knowledge.
Let's talk for a few minutes, Stanley Fish. Our topic here is Doing What Comes Naturally, your collection of essays. Let's talk about what an English professor has to say to the legal profession. Here we're back to the question of what, interpretation?
Yes, we are. I came to an interest in the legal academy through playing basketball with a friend who was at the time a professor at the University of Maryland Law School and now is at the University of Virginia Law School. And we began to talk about our work along with a third friend, Walter Michaels, an English professor at Johns Hopkins University, and discovered that many of the issues in the legal academy and the literary academy were the same, sometimes with different names, sometimes with the same name. But the word interpretation was the large word that covered both fields.
But aren't we really running some risks here when we talk about, I don't want to paint a bleak picture on either side, but, you know, the sort of flourishes and the elan, the imaginativeness that a literary critic brings to a text, isn't that really kind of dangerous if we turn that sensibility loose on these sacred canons of our laws and the things that regulate our society? Yes or no?
No. Or yes and no.
All right.
It seems to me that one must realize that the legal culture has its own constraints, in the sense that the arguments that you can put forward and the ways in which you can marshal them will depend on the norms of practice in place.
So here we're back to this question of the contextual,
that's right,
kind of assumptions that we're
making.
Let's
imagine, for example, a judge who, after having heard two lawyers present cases for the defense and for the prosecution, said, "Well, you've both done very well." And then he turned to one and said, "I particularly like that metaphor of the sun,"
mm-hmm,
"that you allowed to run through your arguments." And I thought, he says, turning to the other, that the way in which you marshaled certain images of shadow and light was in fact extraordinary. Indeed, your performances were so brilliant that I find it difficult to choose between them, and therefore I will not choose.
Uh-huh.
Now, although that might be a perfectly acceptable mode of decision or assessment by a literary critic, were a judge to do it, he would, of course, immediately be challenged, not to say impeached or taken off the bench. So in other words, this is going to sound like a tautology, and in a sense it is. The fact that you understand yourself to be a judge or a lawyer when you're doing judging or lawyering is in itself already a constraint, and a rather complexly layered constraint, which means that you already, because of your own sense of who you are and the enterprise in which you're operating, you already know that there are certain kinds of moves that will be acceptable, yeah, others that will be questionable, and others that will be simply ruled out of court.
It throws up a wall around all of this flowery language and this,
well, it's not
what,
so much
sort
a,
of succumbing
it's
to
not
these
so much
literary
that
devices.
It throws up a wall is that it transforms them into legal stuff. The,
mm-hmm,
the mistake is to think that it's there's nothing wrong with bringing literary and stylistic techniques into the law, but that doesn't mean that you make the law literary. What that means is that the legal world now has accommodated and turned into its own substance something else. Of course, it is true that in both contexts, let's say the context of literary criticism and the context of legal practice, that you're trying to do the same thing, which is to persuade. In one case, to persuade someone to a reading of a poem or a novel,
mm-hmm,
in the other, to persuade someone to the reading of a particular set of facts. But of course, that general similarity shouldn't obscure the real differences, that is, the differences in terms like the ones I described before. A literary critic can suspend judgment, can throw up his or her hands at the end of an exercise and say, I can't decide. That's not available as an option for most people working in the legal culture.
Judge Wapner isn't going to talk in those terms
no,
to us.
No.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Stanley Fish. Your book is Doing What Comes Naturally. How should we think about the state of literature, the function of literature in our culture here as we look into the new decade? Reflect on that for me in terms of what you do as a literary scholar and in terms of how all of this affects your students.
Well, this goes back, I think, in the direction of the curricular debates. It seems to me that the notion that there is more than one use, although I know that use is a word that will fall harshly on some ears, more than one use to be made of literature. It's often assumed that literature must be that area of our lives that ennobles or enriches, or as Wayne Booth has said in a recent book, makes us fuller and more complex individuals than we could have been without our interaction with great books.
The great books.
Right.
Right.
But in fact, the uses to which literature can be put are many, and I see no reason for ranking them or stigmatizing some because others are to be honored. Sometimes we go to literature for moral instruction. Sometimes we go to literature for aesthetic pleasure, itself a problematic phrase, of course. Sometimes we go to literature for sociological information. Sometimes we go to literature to understand biography or character. And there are, of course, many that I haven't named. It doesn't seem to me that there's an essential use of literary works any more than it seems to me that there is an essential nature or essence of the literary.
Yeah, but now wait a minute, Stanley Fish. The parents listening to this conversation might say, whoops, this guy's a relativist. I'm putting my kids, these tender sensibilities, into this man's hands. Defend that for me.
Well, of course, relativism is not a sin. And I think the burden of proof should be put back on those who think that they are not relativists, in the sense that they stand on or speak from challengeable assumptions.
Contestable.
Contestable assumptions, exactly right.
Yeah.
So that insofar as the assumptions within which any of us stand and from which any of us speak are contestable, then what we say is always true or powerful or persuasive relative to those assumptions. In that sense, we are all relativists, which doesn't mean that we don't believe what we say, that we are
right,
indifferent as to the truth of what we say, but that what it does mean is that the nature of the truths we affirm is in fact a context or assumption specific nature, and therefore, as you said a moment ago, contestable. So I think the charge of relativism is a red herring.
All right. And a final note to our conversation, Stanley Fish. You've talked about Milton. I understand that you admire him, that you go back to him. Name another one of your literary models and tell me why you go back to this particular writer.
Well, I often go back to the writings of George Herbert, who is another 17th century poet. And what interests me about Herbert is the extraordinary rigor of his inquiries. What he is always inquiring into are the conditions of the possibility of whatever he's doing at the moment. There's an extraordinary degree of self-reflexivity about Herbert's work. He makes a plea, or he utters an assertion, or he delivers a judgment, and he is immediately questioning the grounds on which this act that he has supposedly just performed could possibly be done. And he does this in a succession of moves that is forever tightening the screws of his inquiry. And it's that kind of wire-tight dialectic of his work that fascinates me and that I find continually bracing.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Stanley Fish, chairman of the Department of English at Duke University. Stanley Fish's most recent book is Doing What Comes Naturally, a collection of essays published last year by Duke University Press. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 502. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about literature in the United States in the 1930s and in contemporary Latin American cultures. My guests will be Morris Dickstein of Queens College and the City University of New York Graduate Center, and Elspieta Sklodowska-Boehm of the University of Warsaw. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. 9 years ago this week, Pope John Paul II was shot in St. Peter's Square. 2 months later, Mehmet Ali Agha was convicted of the assassination attempt. This week marks the anniversary of the first public performance of John Philip Sousa's march, The Stars and Stripes Forever. That occurred in mid-May 1897. This week also brings us Biographer's Day, in commemoration of the meeting in London during mid-May of 1763 of Samuel Johnson and James Boswell. 10 years ago this week saw the eruption of Mount St. Helens in southwestern Washington State. The volcano blew smoke and ash 11 miles into the sky. Mid-May of the year 1792 saw the opening of what has evolved into the New York Stock Exchange, under the sponsorship of a small group of merchants and brokers. Mid-May birthdays include the movie director, Frank Capra, the black nationalist, Malcolm X, the English composer, Arthur Sullivan, the painter and landscape artist, Thomas Gainsborough, the boxing champion, Joe Louis, and the German physicist, Gabriel Fahrenheit. Finally, this week marks the anniversary for the declaration of war between the United States and Mexico in mid-May 1846. The declaration was merely a formality because the fighting had been a reality since the previous March. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Cultural Criticism and American Society, this week on Soundings. Stanley Fish of Duke University discusses his recent and wide-ranging collection of essays entitled Doing What Comes Naturally. From literary criticism and the writings of John Milton to the complexities of legal theory and the curriculum in American universities, Stanley Fish offers some lively answers and insights. Doing What Comes Naturally, this week on Soundings.